Hello, race fans. Welcome to the Goat Rodeo. Coming out live there with a little bit of the legend of K.O. Yarbrough by Jay Sellers and the crew. Great song by our buddy Jay Sellers and the crew, whoever that crew is. Y'all heard of the crew before, haven't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we have.
I was in the crew at one time. I was part of the crew. Now it says Alex Nickerson is online, so I'm going to add him here. Say hello, Jack.
Hello, Jack.
Say hello, Bobby.
Hello, Bobby.
Say hello, Tim.
Hello, Tim.
Hello, Walls.
Danica. I'm sure glad Patrick. We're having a show again tonight. It's been a long time, it seems like.
So, let's see how this works here. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Hello, Alex. Man, it's noisy. He came on noisy, didn't he? Hi, Alex.
Hello.
Alex is here.
Are you hearing me?
Yeah. All right, so you're over-modulating just a tick. Back off your mic just a little bit, and you'll be fine.
Okay.
How you doing tonight, Alex?
Good, and you?
Good. Alex Nickerson joins us.
All right.
All right. How about that? He has a Nickerson Toriel or an Alex Toriel or something tonight.
Nickerson Toriel.
So what are we going to call it, Alex?
Knick-knack. Paddy whack.
Knick-knack.
I like what Tim said, the paddy wagon.
The paddy whack. All right.
Knick-knack, paddy whack. Give the dog a bone.
Yeah, it has been a while since we've all been here, gathered up, but glad to be back. We're down a Hugh and down a Cody tonight, but nevertheless, we've gained.
Hugh's at a birthday party.
Bobby actually came back.
Come out of retirement.
Jack, he's back.
I'm back.
From medical leave.
Hey, Jack was on medical leave for a week or two there, three, whatever. But anyway, cool beans. So I got to tell on myself a little bit. I'm gonna tell a little bit of story here. I'm 62 years old. Y'all knew that. Most of you did. I probably did one of the stupidest things I've ever done in my life.
Again?
Yeah, Sunday, okay? We live on a tidal marsh, and when the tide's out, every now and then there's the tide will bring in stuff and leave it. And it left a blue barrel that's been there for 2 weeks. So I decided I'm going to go out there and get that blue barrel when the tide goes out. So I went and got me a pair of knee-high boots. You guys are familiar with puff mud?
Mm-hmm. Oh,
no.
Yeah. Bob was raised on it.
So within about 10 yards of getting out there, I was up to my waist in puff mud. Couldn't move.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was going to be the end of me right there. I was sitting there thinking, how's this going to go in the headlines?
How did you get out?
Idiot dies in puff mud. Or what? And Kay was videoing the whole thing whole time. She's up on the porch videoing, and he's almost there. You know, I said, would you please stop videoing this?
All she had to do was yell, Gator!
Oh, I know.
And you'd have come popping out of there.
Yeah. I can see the headline now, cause of death, plufferfish.
So I decided to go after the barrel anyway. Okay, I was so close. I finally got to where I could touch it, and it had some little holes drilled in the bottom of it, but my index finger was too big to go in the hole. I could get my little finger up to the first joint in one of the holes and tried to pull the barrel to me because I was thinking I might need that barrel to get out of here, you know. Couldn't get it there, and finally I just kept sinking. I was up over my waist, and I finally said, I got to figure out how to get out of here, and the only way I could get out was get on my belly so that I wouldn't sink, you know, a lot more surface on top of the mud, and wallow my way to the shore. And that I did.
Has Kay got that on video?
Yeah, she's got it on video.
And the barrel's still there.
The barrel's still there.
On Facebook.
Yep. My phone was ruined. My pistol was full of pluff mud. My car keys are still permanently black, you know.
I know exactly what you're describing, Jeff. Exactly.
I've never been so tired in my life. I was exhausted, man. Couldn't do it.
He was out there in the marsh grass.
Yep.
Is the show going to be on TV tonight?
It is. I got to go put it on there. Yeah, I forgot to go put it up. But
that would be nice to show that video once on TV.
Oh, yeah. Let me tell you something. You're never going to see that video.
Yeah, that one's never going to see.
I have threatened Miss Kay. That video will never be public. Okay? That's what I mean.
She can be bought.
So, Jack, what went on this week? Let's get some racing discussion going. Now, have you heard about my mud experience? I just thought I'd.
Well, we had a very popular win in the Cup Series this week with Ryan Blaney. I think I've never heard anybody say anything bad about him and the Wood Brothers. So I think everybody was happy about that.
You know what's amazing is the Wood Brothers have been somewhat of a part-time race team forever.
Yes.
And they still remain relevant and competitive. Think about that.
I was thinking about that as all that was unfolding, how after all these years, they're still basically intact as a original team. The only thing even close to them, and this ain't very close, is Richard Petty Motorsports, and that is not basically intact. It's sort of a different team with his name on it.
Now, are they still operating out of Stuart, Virginia? Or
no, they moved to Charlotte some time ago.
They're in Harrisburg.
Yeah, I figured that.
It's interesting, though, to me to think about, you know, you talk about how competitive it is and how these guys have to, you know, really have all this multi-gazillion dollar equipment and the hordes and hordes of people to be competitive. And here's little old Woods Brothers.
Yep.
They still do it, man. When everything's – the opportunity's just right, well, they can still do it.
They got a good driver, too. Yeah. Blaney's a good driver.
And he is such a mature guy. He did no stupid burnout, destroying a perfectly good car. Just went up so old school, so classy, got the flag and drove back to victory lane. I mean, that's the way you do it.
Yeah, it is.
The only thing he could have added was stop and let the crew jump on and ride the hood or the top
or the trunk or whatever, however they could hold on.
I saw where John Woods posted that the pilot that drives him, the plane, cut donuts on the airfield before he took off.
You know, John Wood was racing for a while.
Yep.
You
know,
John Wood came to Shallotte Point go-kart track in the 90s and raced a go-kart. It was sponsored by Sitgo, number 21. I'm serious.
He raced on the Hooters Pro Cup
circuit. A mile from my house, he came. Like, he was like going to be the heir apparent to the Wood Brothers. Obviously that didn't work out. But,
I'll tell you what's got me ticked off.
Okay.
And this is 2 weeks in a row. The Cup race at Dover ended under the yellow flag. Did not have a green flag finish. The truck race at Pocono last week also ended under a yellow flag. When in the world is NASCAR going to get rid of that damn overtime line and this green-white checker? If they'd go to the last five laps being run under green, it would eliminate a lot of things like the gas mileage races because everybody's going to have to prepare for it a lot more than they do now. So that would take part of that away.
So and what are you saying?
I say last five laps under green.
What about if you have a caution in the last five laps?
You run five laps under green.
You got to run five you continuous got, laps.
Yeah, that business about the advertised distance, that's been out. That's out the window anyway with the green-white checker. I think you have a lot less wrecks with five laps under green than you do with the desperation lap trying to get to the overtime line. At least drivers have a few laps to set up somebody to pass. Yeah, that's the way they do it at the Snowball Derby, and I think it works out great. And you see a green flag, a checkered flag, green flag finish.
Good luck trying to pull that off at Talladega or Watkins Glen.
I think it would still work.
I think they ought to go back letting them finish under the caution, frankly.
Yep, I don't like finish under the caution. I understand racing back to the caution, how that can be dangerous, but I don't like finishing the race under a caution. So I'm done.
All right, so let's get right into the nitty-gritty. Tim, take it away.
Well, I just wanted to approach the issue tonight of class and lack thereof that we witnessed at Pocono this past weekend. The class act was, of course, Ryan Blaney and the Wood Brothers. I have liked Ryan Blaney since he stepped into the Cup division, and I think what he displayed at Pocono was exceptional class all the way around, especially when Mr. Bush tried to run him into the grass. You know, Ryan could have easily wrecked that M&M car with one more little bump, and I think if Kyle had tried it again, he might have done it. But I'm very proud of him. I am so happy that there was no burnout. The burnouts disgust me. I think that's one of the worst parts in the end of the race, whether they finish under yellow checkers or whatever. It's just absolutely crazy when they do something like that. Now, the total lack of class comes from Miss Danica Patrick. She was, after practice up there at Pocono, was walking back to the garage area, and someone asked her for an autograph, and she just not only ignored him, but was kind of rude and insulted him. So some fans standing on the other side of the fence booed her. This is all on video. You can go watch it if you haven't already. So she goes over to the fence, and she spends probably 2.5 minutes at the fence talking to these, cussing these people out, more or less. And she said, her famous quote out of this is, "I am an effing person." But she didn't use effing. She used the F word, the F. "I am a effing person. I am paid to drive race cars and win races." Well, Danica, babe, you've not earned your money. How many races have you won? Pardon me? But I think that's the total lack of class. You know, you think about it, and I think what set it off that home even more was watching the end of the race with the 43 and 21 pulled up side by side to come around. That was like a flashback in time, all those years in the 70s when I used to love to watch the Pearson and the Petty battles that they had everywhere. But I think that shows you two different perspectives on what we have in racing today. I think we have some class. We've got some class in young drivers coming along, which Ryan Lady is one. And we have no accolades. Miss Danica Patrick shoot in spades. Up there, I'm finished.
All right. Well said, sir. So now for the Nickersontorial.
You want me to give my 2 cents already?
Yeah. Unless you want to respond to Tim, you can respond to Tim before you go if you want to.
No, I can't respond to Tim because I'm not quite too familiar with what he's talking about. Except, I can't believe it, having read enough stuff over the years and opinion columns, especially back when Danica was in IndyCar. So, anyway, I shall move along. And the title of this piece is Lipstick on a Pig.
Funny I mentioned Danica.
Hurt the pig.
Her name's about to come up. Don't worry. Quit painting lipstick on pigs. A pig is a pig, no matter whether it has lipstick or pearls. It's still a pig, even if you tell me it's a boar or a sow. It's still a pig when it's sitting on your plate in that delicious form known to us as bacon. Sunday night, my social media greeted me with the usual fleet of posts related to the results of that day's NASCAR race. I wasn't too surprised to see that Ryan Blaney had won his first Cup Series race. I refused to use the terms Premier or Monster Energy. Though it's different, he did it at Pocono and under perfectly normal circumstances. The joy for the Wood Brothers team was explosive. And it got me thinking. It wasn't really the Wood Brothers. At the end of the day, it's a Penske-provided Ford engine and chassis, and they have Penske engineers working with them to, more or less, produce a carbon copy of the cars Brad Keselowski and Joey Logano are driving. The car is built at the Wood Brothers shop and crewed at the track by the Wood Brothers, with employees chosen by the Wood Brothers. But in the current era of NASCAR, the Penske-provided machinery way overwhelms any disadvantage created by otherwise being prepared by the Wood Brothers. Look at the sport. Furniture Row Racing is a Colorado-based extension of Joe Gibbs Racing, complete with Gibbs equipment and a driver running a Gibbs-funded second car just to be able to circumvent the four-car rule. Hendrick Motorsports, until this season, had an effective 8-car operation, as the Stewart Haas cars were de facto Hendrick cars, with, in this scenario, stark performance differences created by the men at the shop on their computers. When SHR was ahead of the two Hendrick cars, were still winning many races, albeit with both teams only, at that time, having two competitive drivers. Can you imagine how different the sport would have been if the current sport had the 60s factory team structure, or vice versa? I counted 10 factory Chevrolets, 9 factory Fords, and 6 factory Toyotas in Sunday's race, and I acknowledge that the level of support varies. In the 60s and 70s, there were Dodge, Plymouth, Ford, Mercury, AMC, Pontiac, Chevrolet, Oldsmobile, and Buick at different points. At most points, one would find four or five of those fielding competitive cars. What would 1963 or 1964 look like if Plymouth, Pontiac, Ford, Dodge, Chevy, and Mercury, as they all ran that season, those years, each had A, four factory cars, and B, at least two cars and satellite teams running the entire 55 or 62 race car slaughter. I count 20 or so regular drivers winning races in about 1 year on either side of 63. Add in several drivers from other series who won, and a few drivers came really close. Even under such circumstances, you're still 9 to 20 cars shy of having a comparable factory commitment to today. You have to count guys like Crawfish, Kreider, and Larry Thomas for good measure. Let's flip it. What would today look like if Jimmy Johnson and Dale Jr. were the only Chevy drivers, Matt Kenseth and Martin Truex the only Toyota drivers, and Brad Keselowski the only Ford driver? Everybody else has to either A, run full-time for himself with zero factory support, or B, run only select races at Daytona, Talladega, Charlotte, Atlanta, and Michigan, etc. for factory teams. We can use the masculine since Danica Patrick would never survive under such circumstances. It's all about painting that lipstick nice and thick on that pig. The thicker you paint it, the more blemishes will be hidden. Once you blob lipstick in enough places, it begins looking more and more like the makeup drawer threw up than someone hiding blemishes. It becomes an uglier pig than before. Drown it enough, and it'll eventually look like a walking, wanking blob of lipstick. Thank you, Jeff.
That's it.
Good job, Alex.
That was great. So
yeah, I'm blotting my lipstick right now.
So what do you really think?
What do I really... Well, what I'm getting at is, as much as I was, you know, kind of... I was happy when I saw the Wood Brothers had won a race. At the same time, you know, the Wood Brothers team now is... pretty much, Brian Blaney's driving an extension of Penske. It's just they give a lot of support to the Wood Brothers because they are not ready to commit to a full third-time car run out of their shop yet, because last time they did that, that was a disaster with Kurt Busch, Ryan Newman, and Sam Hornish driving. So, you know, I feel like when Trevor Bain won, that was the Wood Brothers actually winning the race on their own volition. Here, it feels more or less like a Penske light win, just like Martin Truex winning feels like a Gibbs light win.
Got it. Cool. Very cool.
What was the deal? What's everyone's opinion on the Hendrick cars, all of their brake issues at Pocono? Were they running too light of rotors or too light of sump pads or whatever? Two of three cars.
I don't know. Do stock cars have any brake bias?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they got.
Yeah, if you run the brake bias too far forward, can't you burn them up quickly?
Well, that's the downfall of having a multi-car team, is you're probably getting all your parts from the same place or making the parts at the same place.
Yeah, but maybe those two cars were running them.
At some point in time, they decided we're going to run these cars at Pocono and we're going to run these components
right
on them.
That was a
decision made, I don't know, a month ago.
And they do it on all the cars in the team.
Do it on all the cars. I tell you, Pocono is a scary track if you have a brake issue at the end of that straightaway. You got some serious speed to contend with and a big wall. A track like that would never get built and approved today. Pocono is just a beneficiary of when it was built, because it is a crazy,
yes, it is,
potentially dangerous track. But they had, man, Jimmy Johnson was a brake issue, no question about that. Dale Jr., by his own admission, kept having shifting problems. That was a little bit rare, wasn't it?
Pocono is one of the few tracks they still shift at.
Of course, it's the only one, right?
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah.
Well, the straightaway, how long is that front stretch? Is it?
I think 5,700 feet.
That's longer than a mile.
Well, it is longer than a mile.
Yeah, they did the analysis on there. It's longer than any straightaway in anywhere in NASCAR, and it's, I think, twice as long as the back straightaway at Daytona.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, it's twice as long as the back straightaway at Daytona, and then the other shoot, not the short shoot, but the other shoot is twice as long as back straight away at Charlotte. I think that's correct, but don't quote me on that.
Wow, I never thought about it in those terms. That's interesting.
Yeah, here we go.
It's humongous.
Per the Pocono site, the front stretch is, actually I was way off, 3,700 feet in length and 100 feet wide.
Yeah, it's kind of an anomaly to itself. I mean, there's never going to be another Pocono, at least never one that's going to get a cup race. But the skimp on the brakes there could have some disastrous results. And,
absolutely true. Yeah.
You can get a ton of speed up. Okay.
All right, Bopper, you're next.
Well, I've got a heartwarming story of sorts. A heartwarming story. Jack and I have talked off and on about this story, off and on for years, because we both know it. And it's a story that keeps running through our lives, and it'll come up, and then it fades away, then it keeps coming back.
5 years later, bam,
it comes back again. Yeah, it comes again. And we've told y'all about the big picture, but to give a brief review, there was this old timey racer in the 50s. Of course, he wasn't old timey then. He was a 50s era NASCAR sportsman racer, 37 Ford coupe with a flathead, and his name was Walt Zawoski. His parents immigrated from Eastern Europe in the early part of the century, and somehow, I don't know this part of the story, but they settled in the greater Wilmington, North Carolina area, a little town north of Wilmington called Burgall. It's where he actually lived on a dairy farm. And, Jack, you managed a plant there.
I certainly did for about 5 years.
This in the 70s?
No. This in the 80s? This was much later than that. This was in the 90s, mid-90s. And I just never connected in my head that Walt Zawoski was living in Burgall. For some reason, I thought he lived in Castlehaven.
That's what I thought. That is what, all the time that I remember him racing in the 60s, they always said he lived in Castlehaven. Yeah. And I asked Walt about that in later years, and he said he had briefly lived in Castlehaven in conjunction with a job that he had in Wilmington or something. It was just a brief temporary residence. But I thought all that time he lived in Castlehaven.
Me too.
So we were both psyched out on that. Well, anyway, Walt Zawoski is this 50s era racer that Jack and I, as kids, we grew up watching him. He was in the field, and he was real competitive. He won a lot of races. And in Jack's case, you can remember him at Coastal Speedway.
Yeah, I remember him at Coastal Speedway, old raggedy blue and white number 17. And then he ran at Ramby in the early 60s. And then he disappeared, as far as I knew. And one night I went to Little River in 1968, and I'll be damned if he wasn't there.
But the same car. Well, I first saw him. My first experience of Walt Zawoski was at Carolina Beach in 1964. Hmm. Of course, the track was so terrible there, you couldn't tell if he was fast or not. But that was my first encounter with Walt. And then he raced right on. You know, local racing seemed to pick up a lot of momentum in the 60s. Right. You know, tracks started springing up everywhere. And Walt, he just literally pulled his old car back out of mothballs and started racing again. And it was 50s era technology. Yep. Flathead, everything. Straight out of the 50s. But he was winning. He was competitive with 60s era jalopy and hobby type cars. Most of them were six cylinder straight sixes, and he had a flathead.
And he was a big guy.
Yeah, and he
real big guy,
real physically, real big. And when I knew him, he pulled the race. He flat towed the race car, with a 53 Studebaker, the same kind that they made Daytona modifieds out of. Remember them 53 Studebaker Hulks? That was his street car. And he would pull this old race car through the track with that Studebaker. Just him and his wife. His wife's name was Barbara. That's what the B stood for on B-19. And they didn't ever have no crew or nothing. It was just them two. And anyway, you know, we raced through the 60s and everything, and even into the early 70s. And racing, at least around here, local racing sort of got to a crossroads in the early 70s. Pavement came in some places, and nobody really knew what direction local racing was going to go. Was it going to be paved? Was it going to be dirt? Was it going to be this? Was it going to be that? And it was sort of at a crossroads, and I think by that time Walt had sort of probably realized that his old car and its technology, no matter what happened, it was probably going to be outdated. And I think he just decided to hang it up, literally. But fortunately, unbeknown to anybody, he was a dairy farmer and had this dairy barn, pretty big building. He had two race cars. They looked just alike. He put them both in this building and just left them. Just drove her off the track one day and put it in the dairy barn, and still had the clay on it, still had everything. Just perfectly preserved, like a mummy almost. And this would have been in the early 70s. Well, time went by. It was early 2000s when the internet really first got going, and all of this vintage stuff started coming up on various sites. And for some reason, I looked up Walt Zawoski's name and called him on the phone one day. Just got up the nerve. You ever called somebody out of the clear blue sky to start a conversation? That's kind of awkward. The beginning of it's awkward, isn't it?
Yeah. It's awkward because you're not selling something. You're asking for information on something.
Yeah, you're wanting.
Which is different.
Yeah, and so I kind of got up the nerve, and I knew he was sort of a recluse. I remembered that from being around him at the track. And his wife answered the phone, and she immediately said, "We're having a bad thunderstorm. I got to hang up." And I really thought she was giving me the runaround, which she actually was. And I hollered real quick who that I was and what I was and what I wanted to talk about, never thinking that she would connect me with anything, but she did. She stopped and she started talking, and she got anyway, she put Walt on the phone, and he just, we had this long conversation, and I had several more after that. And he told me that the race cars was out in his barn, and they were just like they were, and he always said, "I'll make flower pots out of them before I'll sell them. Everybody's wanting to buy them cars, and I ain't going to sell them." And so I didn't want to buy them. I just wanted to go see them. I would ask him every time, "When can we go?" "Oh, well, you can come here and look at them." "Yeah, that ain't no problem." But never really happen. He would always have, "Well, I got to go here. I got to do this. It's too hot. It's too this." And he finally told me one day, he said, "Well, even if you come, you couldn't see them. There's so much junk that's piled on them. Lumber, this, that, everything in the world is just, they've just accumulated so much junk in this building that you can't even see them." So I guess that was the truth, that even if I went, I couldn't see them. So it was kind of cool, though. He told me some bits and pieces about the cars, and which I'm sure he would have never done back in the day. They had a flathead, of course, and he said, "I had Canadian heads on it," because Canadian heads were aluminum, and that was a hot speed secret. And you paint them, and then nobody could tell unless they put a magnet on it. And he had, he told me he ran a Lincoln distributor, because a Lincoln distributor had centrifugal advance. But I learned last night that a Lincoln distributor was from a V12, and Walt had it rigged up in a V8 flathead. So anyway, he told me about the cars, and I never got to see him. And as it turns out, these conversations I was having with Walt was at the very tail end of his life. He passed away. He just died. I had learned that his health was real bad anyway, and so he died. And so I didn't know what was going to happen, didn't know anything. And a few more years might have went by, and I learned learned as a result of them Maple Hill cars. Remember the Maple Hill cars?
Absolutely.
We went up there to see them and decided to go by Waltz one day. And there was a man with a backhoe dragging one of Walt's cars out of that dairy barn. Me and Bill Tripp went, and we like had a heart attack. We slammed on brakes and run up there in the yard. And this man that was dragging the car with the backhoe was the next door neighbor, and he had bought the estate. And he told us that this was the second of the two cars that he had sold the other one. The good one, somebody from Swansboro bought it, and that's all that I knew. Somebody from Swansboro, which is a little town on the coast up about Morehead City, somewhere along in there. And so that's all. That was the end of the story until yesterday. Jack Walker found this picture and posted it on my page, and lo and behold, it's the Walt Zawoski car. That is it. I started writing comments and everything about it, and the man that posted it started answering back, and he was just a poster. He wasn't the owner, but he put me in contact with the guy that actually owned it, who knew almost no history of the car. The current owner didn't know anything, but very much wanted to know everything, and his name is Ken Burleson. Now the new owner of the B-19, and he bought it from the Swansboro man at the Good Guys Car Show at the Charlotte racetrack a year or so ago. That's where the Swansboro man took it to that show for the purpose of selling it. And Ken Burleson, he's a racing vintage aficionado just like we are, recognized and loves Ole Miss, and recognized it for what it was. He just appreciated everything about it and bought it.
He had no idea who the driver was.
He had no idea of nothing. He didn't know anything. So he was just delighted. You know, I have known the car since I was about 10 years old, that I could tell him all, you know, these bits and pieces of a lifetime of being familiar with this old car. Because he just knew some rumors that people had told him. But when Ken got the car, it still had the clay, and it still got the clay on it from the last time it raced, which would have been sometime in the 70s. Is that unbelievable or what?
Yeah.
And, of course, he's not going to try to disturb it. I don't know that. I can't think of there might be another car in the world that's this perfectly encapsulated, but it would have to be a good one to beat this, because of the eccentricity of Walt Zawoski's personality, him keeping it in that building all these years. It was just like being in a time vault.
Yep.
Exactly like that.
A true barn find.
It is a true barn find, and now it's just like it was. Yep. It is. But so with just a little bit of fiddling around, Ken got the motor where it was stuck, of course, after all these years of setting up, but it didn't take much fiddling with it to get the motor unstuck, and it didn't take too much more fiddling around with it to get it started up. It actually started up, but it was pumping water out of the number 7 cylinder. It was running, but she was pumping water. So he had to take it apart to try to fix that. And he took the heads off and he took the intake off. And he found so much trick stuff, homemade tricks. And he was a good enough expert to recognize what he was looking at. To start with... it has got, right this minute, domed pistons in a flathead Ford. I wish Bill Blair was on here now. He would appreciate this. And they're engraved with standard on the top, like standard bore. Ken measured the bore. It's 125 thousandths overboard now, which means that if these are standard pistons, they come out of there for some other kind of motor. So he done some research, or maybe he knew on his own, but he said that the Oldsmobile Rocket 88 motor that was so fast back in the early 50s had dome pistons and was the same size as a flathead if you bored it 125 over.
Oh, okay. Huh.
So it could be Oldsmobile pistons, but that meant Walt had to rig up all the rod mess, all that kind of stuff. You didn't just get on the internet and order rods and pistons from an Oldsmobile to fit a flathead, and you know, you had to make everything. So somehow he had done all that. He had handmade.
Did he have a machine shop in that dairy?
He had a welder and a cutting torch. Yeah. He said a 808 Iski cam. It was an intake manifold that Walt had heavily modified and made a homemade adapter to put a Rochester 2-barrel on it. And even back in the day, there was a rumor around the track that Walt Zawoski's car had a Chevrolet fuel pump on it. And I asked him, I said, "Does it got a Chevrolet fuel pump?" He said, "It sure does. It ain't got no Ford flathead pump. She's got a Chevrolet pump, a Rochester carburetor." And if you know much about flatheads, you know that they always had a tendency to have heating problems. They always run in hot mess. Walt's car does not have a fan on it. He did not run with a fan. So he was not. So that makes me think he must have been running on alcohol, probably, which burns a lot cooler. Which back in the day, there wasn't nobody checking nothing. He might have been. He was illegal as the day is long.
Moonshine.
He took the water pumps. You know, a flathead has two of them. Cut every other impeller vane off, and drilled a hole in all the rest of them. He made air passageways through the oil pan. The oil pan had these tubes. He drilled holes through there and then welded a tube to make like an air-cooled thing.
Holy cow.
This was 1950s technology. Advanced technology that he was doing in his back out there in the dairy farm. One day, I remember one night at Little River, he won the race and got protested. They didn't have nobody at the track that knew anything about a flathead, so they just declared him legal. But it would have been this engine with the dome pistons and every kind of thing in the world rigged up on it. He had this distributor that Ken couldn't even figure out how to do it. It was a V12 Lincoln distributor in a V8 car, and somehow Walt had figured out which plugs you had to limp, which terminals on the distributor. He had it rigged up somehow where it was still in time, but when Ken tried to get it going, he couldn't get it to work, so I had to put a regular distributor in it. That's the only thing that's different now. It had the classic handle on the little knob hook on the dashboard where you put her in second gear, and he had an inner tube, like a bicycle inner tube around the seat, that you would hook around the gear shift lever, the holder in third. He said, "What kind of tracks would he been running on where he'd need third gear? Was any tracks that big?" I said, "Yeah, Ramby probably."
Yep.
And probably Jacksonville.
Yep.
Was a half mile.
That's half.
Well, he would have run her in high gear there. Had an inner tube. Tow bar, which came on the car and is still there, was made out of leaf springs, two leaves. But this car is just absolutely perfectly preserved with all of this stuff. He is... Ken Burleson, its current owner, has absolutely no desire to sell it and is negotiating to get it put in a museum, possibly even the NASCAR Museum. He has had a little bit of connections with that. He has was trying to meet with Ray Everham, and they somehow missed seeing each other, but Ray saw the car. Ken was at a show somewhere waiting on Ray to come by, and the one moment he went to go get a drink, a sandwich, Ray showed up. So Ray saw the car, and I'm sure if you know he would recognize it also for what it is, which is just an absolute time capsule. So this is the same story that Jack and I keep keeps showing up.
That's amazing. Yeah.
It is amazing, and it is such an amazing piece. I didn't know all this stuff. Walt had told me just a little teeny bit, but Ken has actually taken the motor, and he's adept enough and sharp enough to recognize what he's looking at. So that's really impressive. I would like Bill Blair, who's a flathead expert, might would recognize those pistons. That might have been a standard trick, but I'm sure it involves some fancy footwork to get the rods and the stroke and all that stuff, which you would have had to done by, just on your own.
Trial and error, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, story has a happy ending. It just keeps going on.
Now if the second car would just surface.
If there's another Walt Zawoski car somewhere out in the radio land, so maybe it'll show up. He had two cars, and both of them were sold. So
were both of them B19?
One of them was 17A.
Oh, 17A, okay.
Actually, Jack and I think both of them were 17 to start with.
Yeah.
Because I remember when Walt painted this one blue, it was in the very tail end of its career.
I don't ever recall seeing the number 19, but I sure saw the number 17
I think
many
he made
times.
When he made painted it blue, I think he made it 19. That's just my theory now, knowing everything. All right, that's my
that's awesome.
Two cents.
That's great. Yeah. How about a Carolina race place, historic race finish?
How about one?
Where are we going, man?
Man, we are staying local. We're going to Myrtle Beach Speedway. Yeah.
Great, cool.
We are going to Myrtle Beach Speedway in 1981.
Oh, well, that is local.
Yeah, kind of late for me. I usually stay in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
That's almost current for you.
Yeah, that's almost current for me. But anyway, here we go. In 1978, Robert Smalley, which, Jeff, you know, of Kingsport, Tennessee.
Had a boathouse.
Formed the National Dirt Racing Association. Smalley's vision was to have a dirt track series paying an unheard-of race purse of over $29,000 at small tracks in the southeast. The winner of each 100-lap race would receive $10,000 for the victory. The first race for the new NDRA series was won by Bobby Thomas at East Alabama Motor Speedway on August 5th, 1978. On September 2nd, 1978, Leon Archer of Griffin, Georgia, won the first NDRA race at Myrtle Beach Speedway. The NDRA series lasted 8 years, ending at the end of the 1985 season. In 1981, the NDRA made its second and final stop at Myrtle Beach Speedway on Saturday night, September 5th. By 1981, and Bobby, I didn't realize this, but by 1981, the race purses were varying at each track, unlike the $29,000 race purse of 1978. The Myrtle Beach Speedway purse for 1981 was $15,000, with $3,000 going to the winner. Buck Simmons had the fastest lap in time trials over the 6/10 mile track. When the race started, Simmons took the lead and held that position until lap 10, when he was passed by Freddie Smith of Kings Mountain, North Carolina. Smith continued to lead the field until lap 65, when he pulled into the pits with an overheated engine. At that point, Larry Moore of Dayton, Ohio, inherited the lead and held it to the checkered flag on lap 100. The first three drivers finished on the lead lap. Not a whole lot of details about the race. Side note, Buck Simmons would end up being the 1981 season champion for the NDRA after 28 events. Also, Freddie Smith won the Hillbilly 100 the very next day, September 6th, in Pennsboro, West Virginia. Buck Simmons also was the winner that Labor Day weekend, as he won the NDRA race at Anderson, South Carolina on Monday, September 7th. Several of the drivers that raced at Myrtle Beach ran all three of these races.
Holy cow.
That is unbelievable.
That is getting across the country.
So when was the Myrtle Beach race on what night?
Saturday night, September 5th.
And the Hillbilly 100 was on
September
Sunday?
September 6th, yep.
The next, that's in Pennsboro. That's a long haul from Myrtle Beach to Pennsboro.
That's why I put it in here. And then back to Anderson.
And did Freddie Smith won at Pennsboro?
Yeah. And then back to Anderson for the NDRA race on Monday night. So anyway, here's the way they finished at Myrtle Beach. NDRA race, September 5th, 1981. The winner, Larry Moore, Dayton, Ohio, followed by Buck Simmons, Baldwin, Georgia, Jerry Inman, Bruce, Mississippi, Ronnie Franklin, Gaffney, South Carolina, Tommy Snell, Augusta, Georgia, Charles Powell III, Somerville, South Carolina, Laverne Jordan, Conway, South Carolina, Laverne Todd, Conway, South Carolina, Don Smith, not sure where he's from. Bobby, you may know.
He was a local.
Because he was semi-local.
I
he was around
to say
here.
Myrtle Beach, Saucus Tea,
yeah,
somewhere
I have no idea. Mike Cox, Hemingway, South Carolina, was 10th.
That's Marion Cox's son. Yep.
Joe Meadow, Beckley, West Virginia. Edward Jordan, Conway, South Carolina. Freddie Smith, Kings Mountain, North Carolina. Jack Boggs, Webbville, Kentucky. Rick Rogers, Knoxville, Tennessee, was 15th. Followed by Raven Clark. Again, I don't know where he's from.
I don't know him.
Buddy Rogers, Knoxville, Tennessee. Jim McNeil, Charleston, South Carolina. Sonny Martin, I'm not sure where he was
from. He's from Conway.
Conway?
He's the vintage racer now.
Is that right? I'm going to put him on my list then. It's Conway. And the 20th and final position, Mike Owens from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
That race had a lot of local cars.
Yeah, it had local cars, and it had faraway cars.
I didn't ever know Jim McNeil run dirt.
Yeah. So to put that trip to Pennsboro in proper perspective,
how many
on today's
miles?
Highways, okay, it's 8 hours and 53 minutes. Drive.
So they probably left right after the race, drove all night.
Freddie Smith, I can tell you what he towed
536 miles.
Wow.
He had a one-ton Ford box van, a E350 box van at that time. That's dragging a race car from Myrtle Beach to Penn. That's in the mountains there.
Yeah. So, and I believe Larry Moore, Buck Simmons, Jerry Inman, let's see who else. If I remember,
I wasn't at this race, Jack, but I remember it because Larry Moore created just a buzz in the local racing fabric. Just everybody was just. I don't know exactly what he done, but he was very impressive as far as
what number was that car? I know
it
was
like
red.
P1 or something.
Yeah,
like
it was
that.
Red. I didn't go to this race either, I don't think, Bobby, but I went to a couple NDRA races. I went to one at Hartsville, Darlington, and I went to one at Somerville, I believe.
Charles Powell III was in that race. Edward Jordan done pretty good.
Yeah, he was 12th out of 20. And I assume there was only 20 cars.
Well, Laverne Jordan was better, and he was 7th. That's a local.
Yeah. And Tommy Snell, he raced here all the time. He was 5th. From Augusta, but
now that race had some heavyweights: Buck Simmons and Larry Moore. And
what I was getting ready to say: Larry Moore, Buck Simmons, Jerry Inman, and Freddie Smith. I know we're in all three of these races that week.
But I'll tell you what: when Freddie Smith, when he went to Pennsboro the next day, he was in a hornet's nest of competition there. That was big even then. I mean, everybody and his brother would have been there.
Right.
For him to pull in there from another race somewhere and with not a whole lot of practice time and all of that and win.
And you know it was the same car.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't have a whole stable of cars.
It was the same one.
Yeah.
Jack.
Yes.
I just found and posted the link in the chat. There's actually a webs page. It has all the winners for the NDRA history listed race by race.
Yes, I've seen that. Yep.
Yeah. Quite the impressive list.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Buck that, Simmons, Larry yep. Moore, Rodney Combs. I see Jeff Purvis, Kenny Brightbill.
Yep, and they ran 28 races in 1981.
When this time frame is very early Scott Blomquist is starting the
yeah,
and you know who he was chasing? You know who Scott Blomquist decided he was going to emulate? Everything he does, I'm going to do. Everywhere he goes, I'm going. Was Jeff Purvis?
Yep,
he was the man.
I was going to guess Jeff Purvis.
He was the man, according to Scott Blomquist, that he was going to model himself after. So a lot of all that was set in motion there is still going on now in dirt racing. It's unfortunate the NDRA was like a bottle rocket. It was so successful it like burned itself out. It just couldn't.
Well, I didn't realize that they started having varying purses. I did not know that. That was news to me.
I did know that because in the early days. Well, of course, in at this time, 3,000 was still a good purse.
But when they started in 78, every race was 10,000.
Every, which was just
to the winner.
Yeah. So over the top, you can't even grasp it. Even now, right this second, a $10,000 race gets a lot of attention.
Absolutely.
And they were running for it every race in the late 70s. Yeah. That was just so over the top.
And they didn't just race in a tiny little region. They ran up and down the East Coast to Maryland and everywhere
and you
else.
Know, it wasn't almost Ohio. No time before
Mississippi.
Before Stroh's came on as their national sponsor. That was almost simultaneous. I'm trying to think of the promoter's name of the NDRA.
Robert Smalley.
Robert Smalley. He was a... he was ahead of it. He was just ahead of the curve. I mean, he was.
It actually put a big spark into dirt track racing. I mean,
it that's going on now. Yeah. That's really the reinventing of dirt track racing was on the decline.
Right.
And I read an autobiography on Robert Smalley one time, and he said he thought, well, there's all these great drivers. Why shouldn't they be as celebrated and as famous as the NASCAR drivers? That was his original thought, that if what they need is a circuit that focuses on them and is grandiose and big money and all that. That was his original premise, that I'm going to make these guys famous just like the Yarboroughs and Petties and all of them. And he made an excellent beginning at doing all that. He really did. So that and Myrtle Beach was a pivotal player in the NDRA.
Two races, only two.
But one of them was like the second ever.
No, the 1978 race was like the third or fourth.
It was very early in the NDRA's own history.
Yeah, it was right up there. Alex has probably got a list in front of him. He can see in 1978 that Myrtle Beach was pretty close to the beginning.
Race number three.
Number three.
Yep, September the 2nd. I went to that race.
I did too. I was at that race. Yes. I mean, you could not go to that race if you were a race fan, if you lived anywhere around
and
here.
And you sat there with your jaw dropped the whole time because you realized, man, a new day has dawned.
Yep.
These old cars that local people had was like army tanks, what?
Yep.
The side of them NDRA cars. Cool stuff. Cool stuff, Jack.
Yeah, you guys, all of you guys tonight really did. That was some. It was a good bunch of show content there, man. I was glued to my headphones.
Hey, that's why you pay us the big bucks. Oh, wait a minute. Let me think about that.
Speaking of big-time dirt stuff.
It's just a bag of peanuts.
This past weekend was the annual World 100 at Eldora. The winner got $100,000, and the winner, not surprisingly, was Scott Blomquist, who took over about halfway the race and just sort of checked out. But that is a That is a crown jewel, big time event now on the dirt calendar of the not the World 100. I'm sorry, the Dream. I'm sorry, my mistake. The World 100 is in September. The June race is the Dream, and I think the Dream actually pays more. So anyway, all of that kind of stuff was sort of started by what you're talking about here. Yep. So, good stuff.
Very good. Thanks, fellas. Awesome job. Alex, good to have you, man.
I enjoy it.
Nickersontorial.
We'll come up with something better.
Yeah. Come up with a name. It's good. I like it. I like hearing your perspective, man. That's good. Like it. Appreciate it. All right, let's get on out of here. Time to go. Right, Tim?
Whatever you say, you got the clock in front of you.
I also got the controls.
I also have the solar clock in front of me.
All right, you're a solar clock kind of guy. All right, what time does it say it is?
7:56 and 29 seconds.
I'm at 27. Okay, yours is wrong. All right, fellas. Thanks. Thanks, everybody,
man,
for putting this thing together.
42 seconds.
Appreciate you very much. Thanks to fans for letting us be part of you Tuesday. We love you. Glad to be back. And as always, we'd like to say a special thanks to the men and women that serve our military. Thank you for doing that so that we can do this. Each and every one of you, good night. God bless all of you.